Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Welcome, Moors, to Moors Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana El Bay, and we have an exciting lineup for you this evening. We're going to get down to some very, very important things. We're dealing with the brothers today, and sisters, of course, I want you to tune in. We're going to be doing a new broadcast Sunday where we're going to deal with the money and the finances and all of this stuff, and after that, we're going to address the sisters inside the United States of America. I have a great deal of information to deliver, so I'm going to make this as briefly as I can. We're offering our free articles, the 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Game, and it's very, very important for you to get this. And the way you get it is to email me at tahaka99@yahoo.com. That's tahaka99@yahoo.com. And I can be reached at telephone before 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and the number is area code 904-303-9061. And you can contact me in regards to your library, and everything that you hear this evening will eventually go in there. We had a couple of storms that hit the coast of Florida and knocked out everything, including phone service and everything else, but we got the computer up and running. But in the meantime, what we have done is we have added a ton of information to Tahaka's library. So for those of you who don't have that, you need to contact me, 904-303-9061, before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We put your articles in there, including the forms that you actually fill out under our law and law 2. And those instruments are there in the event that you have problems. If you got marriage, custody, divorce, criminal cases, whatever it is, we put everything there for you. And it's right there in Tahaka's library. And you simply access that by calling me because it's for Moore's. And it's area code 904-303-9061. And we'll get that to you. Now, we're going to be dealing with Moors, Negroes, Coloreds, African-Americans, Black folks, Afro-Americans, and manhood, whatever it is that you're calling yourself. We're dealing with it from a manhood position. And not to say that the Moors are not men, but we're going to just touch up on a few things and remind ourselves of a few things. We got some heavyweights in here that's going to drop some information. And so I'm going to try to deliver as much of this stuff as I can. But I had to go out and drag out one of my most magnificent treasures. And we're going to listen to this brother first, and then after that, then we're going to get down on into the broadcast.
There was two kinds of slaves. There was the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro, they lived in the house with master. They dressed pretty good. They ate good because they ate his food. But he left. They lived in the attic or the basement, but still they lived near their master. And they loved their master more than the master loved himself. They would give their life to save their master's house quicker than the master would. The house Negro, if the master said, "We got a good house here," the house Negro said, "Yeah, we got a good house here." Whenever the master said "we," he said "we." That's how you can tell a house Negro. If the master's house caught on fire, the house Negro would fight harder to put the blaze out than the master would. If the master got sick, the house Negro would say, "What's the matter, boss? We sick. We sick." He identified himself with his master more than his master identified with himself. And if you came to the house Negro and said, "Let's run away, let's escape, let's separate," that house Negro would look at you and say, "Man, you crazy. What you mean separate? Where is there a better house than this? Where can I wear better clothes than this? Where can I eat better food than this?" That was that house Negro. In those days, he was called a house nigger. And that's what we call him today, because we still got some house niggers running around here. This modern house Negro loves his master. He wants to live near him. He'll pay three times as much as the house is worth just to live near his master. And then brag about, "I'm the only Negro out here." "I'm the only one on my job. I'm the only one in this school. You're nothing but a house Negro." And if someone come to you right now and say, "Let's separate," you say the same thing that the house Negro said on the plantation. "What you mean, separate? From America? This good white man? Where you gonna get a better job than you get here? I mean, this is what you say. I ain't left nothing in Africa." That's what you say. Why, you left your mind in Africa. On that same plantation, there was the field Negro. The field Negro, those were the masses. There was always more Negroes in the field than there was Negroes in the house. The Negro in the field caught hell. He ate leftovers. In the house, they ate high up on the hog. The Negro in the field didn't get nothing but what was left of the insides of the hog. They call them chitlins nowadays. In those days, they call them what they were. Guts. That's what you were, a gut eater. And some of you are still gut eaters. The field Negro was beaten from morning till night. He lived in a shack, in a hut. He wore cast-off clothes. And he hated his master. I say he hated his master. He was intelligent. That house Negro loved his master. But that field Negro, remember, they were in the majority. And they hated his master. When the house caught on fire, he didn't try and put it out. That field Negro prayed for a wind, for a breeze. When the master got sick, the field Negro prayed that he died. If someone come to the field Negro and said, "Let's separate, let's run," he didn't say, "Where are we going?" He said, "Any place is better than here." You got field Negroes in America today. I'm a field Negro. The masses are the field Negroes. When they see this man's house on fire, you don't hear these little Negroes talking about, our government is in trouble. They say the government is in trouble. Imagine a Negro, our government. I even heard one say, our astronauts. They won't even let him near the plant. And our astronauts, our Navy. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. Just as the slave master in that day used Tom, the house Negro, to keep the field Negroes in check, the same old slave master today has Negroes who are nothing but modern Uncle Toms, 20th century Uncle Toms, to keep you and me in check, keep us under control, keep us passive and peaceful and nonviolent. That's Tom making you nonviolent. It's like when you go to the dentist and the man is going to take your tooth. You're going to fight him when he starts pulling. So they squirt some stuff in your jaw called Novocaine to make you think they're not doing anything to you. So you sit there and because you got all that Novocaine in your jaw, you suffer peacefully. There's nothing in our book, the Quran, as you call it, Quran, teaches us to suffer peacefully. Our religion teaches us to be intelligent, be peaceful, be courteous, obey the law, respect everyone. But if someone puts his hand on you, send them to the cemetery. That's a good religion. In fact, that's that old-time religion. That's the one that Ma and Pa used to talk about. An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth, and a head for a head, and a life for a life. That's a good religion. And then anybody, no one resents that kind of religion being taught but a wolf who intends to make you his meal. This is the way it is with the white man in America. He's a wolf, and you a sheep. Anytime a shepherd, a pastor, teach you and me not to run from the white man, and at the same time teaches don't fight the white man, he's a traitor to you and me. Don't lay down our life all by itself. No. Preserve your life. It's the best thing you got. And if you got to give it up, let it be even Stephen.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was a classic. I don't have to tell you who that is. But anyway, I just thought I'd run that little plug there because I ran across it the other day. And I listened to it again. I said, my brother and sister, they got to hear this one more time. But now we're getting going to go down on into the broadcast. And we're going to deal with some very, very serious stuff. And I need you to pay very close attention. And don't forget that and don't think that what you're hearing is not relative. It is very, very much relative, and I hope you all got paper and pencil because we're dealing with the heavyweights this evening. And also remember, in order to contact me, you just simply dial area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we'd be more than happy to communicate with you. For your free articles, the 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Gang, contact me at taraka99@yahoo.com. That's T-A-R-A-H-A-K-A 99@yahoo.com.
I met this gentleman about a year ago, having read one of his books, Black on Black Violence, and it had a profound effect on my thinking, and it's something that I think we all need to be exposed to. I won't get into what he will talk about, but simply say that to me, having heard a lot of individuals who have tried to deal with issues, particularly those which affect young people and education. He's one of the few people that I think offers an excellent analysis, but more importantly, a correct analysis, not just an excellent one. Good intentions are wonderful, but if they don't produce the results, it does us no purpose. So without any further ado, I'd like to bring to you an elder, someone who I have a tremendous amount of respect for, and someone that I hope that after leaving here, you will not only purchase his book, but try to use this as a means of accessing further information about your culture, which means about yourself. So let me introduce to you right now, he doesn't like to be called doctor, but I call him that because sometimes people need to hear that to feel that this person is legitimate to speak to them. But we call him Brother Amos Wilson.
Thank you. Thank you very much, my good brother. Appreciate your invitation. I appreciate your coming here today, this afternoon. And, of course, I know you are beginning to feel a bit that spring is in the air. And to come out here on a Saturday afternoon takes some doing, and I certainly appreciate your taking the time. Of course, I think the subject matter warrants the time as well. Death at an early age is the school system setting our children up for failure, is the topic that was suggested to me today and to which I will speak for a bit. Is the school system setting our children up for failure? Very interesting question. Is the school system really doing, has it ever set them up for anything else? It depends on how you measure failure and, of course, how you measure education. In my class at the College of New Rochelle at the campus here at Co-op City, I teach a course called Children at Risk. And during that course, we study an article from a very well-known book in the field called Regulating the Poor. That book describes how welfare policy in this country and how welfare policy historically has been used for political purposes, political and economic purposes. You know, if you hear people talk about welfare today, you would think that welfare was something that was invented in the United States and something that's principally utilized by African people or by Latino people. And we have built up such a mythology around welfare, the welfare mother, the welfare family, you know, until it takes me a whole semester often just to knock out the myths surrounding the concept of welfare and what welfare is really about. There are many people, for instance, who still believe that there are more black people or Latino people on welfare than there are white people. And it's an amazing game as to how the political structure of this country operates on that myth. And they confuse often percentages with absolute numbers. So if we would say that maybe 33 or a third of black people are on welfare, and say maybe 15% of whites are on welfare, people confuse those two things. But when you're talking about 15% of whites, you're talking maybe about 9 million people, you see. As against even 30% blacks, you're talking about something like 5 million. In other words, then, you have 4 to 5 million more whites on welfare than blacks. Why is there a higher percentage of blacks on welfare? Because there are a higher percentage of poor black folk on welfare. It's no big mystery. If poverty is one of the things that qualifies one to receive welfare, then the groups that have a higher percentage of poverty-stricken people will have a higher percentage of people there. It has little to do with the kind of stuff we hear every day about attitudes and people wanting to stay on to have babies and all that other kind of nonsense. As a matter of fact, when you actually look at the average number of children per welfare mother and compare them with the average number of children per mother not on welfare, I think you'd be quite surprised to find out that that average is not very different, you see. But myths are hard to put down. When we talk about welfare, you have to start in the 1600s, not in the 1900s, not in the 20th century, but in some place like 1605, 1650, and you have to start in Europe. Welfare, in its present form, essentially was shaped in the 1600s in France and England and Europe. So if you want to study the history of welfare, you don't study the history of black folk on welfare, you study the history of white folk on welfare, and you study the history of welfare in Europe and study it as it was translated to America to get rid of the mythologies. And one of the important things you study, if you study the history of welfare, is to look at its political function. Welfare was not and is not only designed to meet the needs of the poor. To a great extent, we find that welfare was designed to regulate the behavior of the poor and to regulate the economic system so that when the economic system was going through, I'm speaking now in Europe, when Europe moved from what we call feudalism, or from where the great percentage of people were involved in farming and involved in agriculture and moving over into an industrial state, there was a great deal of what we call dislocation. That is, people without jobs, people without homes, because there was a transition taking place between farm work and industrial work. And in that transition, many people lost their farms. They lost their roles on the farm. And unless industrial jobs were available, they literally were left to beg. Often, though, they just did not beg or walk around and beg people to feed them. They became dangerous. They would often protest. They would disturb the peace and cause various other civic disturbances. And it was at the point where the civic disturbances became intolerable that the state of France, England, the cities in France and so forth, decided then to establish what we call welfare programs. In other words, often the welfare programs were created and administered more to control the politics, more to control order, than actually to feed the poor or to meet the needs of the poor. Often welfare was extended during high periods of unemployment or during periods when the nature of the economy was moving from one level of technology to another level, when people then were unemployed and had to be retrained and re-educated in order to operate in the new level of technology. And therefore, welfare would be brought in to sort of to help them over the transition. But when the transition was over, welfare then would be reduced. So you would have an expansion or contraction of welfare, an expansion or contraction of help from the state related to the political nature of what was going on in the state. Essentially then, the function of welfare was to regulate the behavior of the poor. They started getting too outrageous in their behavior. If they started to threaten law and order and so forth, then the dole was expanded. But at the point where law and order could be maintained by other means, the dole was.
Okay. We are going to come back to our brother Amos Wilson. But we're going to deal with something right here now, brothers, and I need you to pay close attention, okay?
because you are male doesn't make you a man. Every male has a third leg. But some males are led by that third leg. Men are not led by your third leg. If your third leg is leading you, you are not a man. If you are making decisions based on what your lower head wants, and then your upper head helps you connive and scheme so that your lower head can find its way into the secret place. You're not a man. You're male. That's what males do. That's what boys do. Manhood isn't based on age. It's based on decisions. It's based on understanding. It's based on principles that you apply to your life and that will help someone else. If what you're doing is self-centered, selfish, about you, about your feelings, your emotions, and what you want, and you're not thinking about your wife, your children, or the people that you affect, either positively or negatively, you are a child. Boy. Kid. 40-year-old man wearing diapers.
Now that's just nasty.
Because you're still a child. If you are a boy and you want to be a boy, you want to stay a boy, and you want to sleep around and get as much as you want, turn this off, go watch the game, get yourself a piece of chicken, have a Coke and a smile. Don't waste your time. This is for men. Boys who want to be men. Males who know that they're boys, who need the extra information to grow into manhood. A man that's truly leading his wife is making decisions that benefit her, is making decisions that are mindful of her, is making decisions that increase their closeness, not making decisions that pull them apart, not making decisions for their boys in benefit of them and not her. If you make a decision that benefits you and your homie instead of your wife, this is why that's dumb. You sleep with her. She has your kids. You put your inside of her. You don't do that to them. No, I hope you don't. That, Let's just say you don't. So why make a decision for anyone else if this is your wife? And this is the one that you have through your marriage and through your commitment have become one with. Destroying her, in essence, destroys yourself because she's the other half of you. That's foolish, and that's something that a boy would do. Take that to the bank. And smoke it when you get there. That's my bad. What kind of behavior have you or the males around you done that you know are not the type of behavior that true men do? And ask yourself honestly, do you really want to be a man, or is being a male with a penis good enough for you? It might be. That might be fine for you. You might be straight, sleeping around, getting your freak on. If that's the case,
moving on.
Being a person and being a man that makes decisions and desires to be a true leader that's worth following is a man that's pursuing manhood. Is our fleshly part of us. It connects us to the planet, to the things that we see, the things that we experience. That's our body. Our spirit is that part of us that's made in the image of God, that's eternal, that will live on after this body no longer holds it. And the mind or the soul is the collection of thoughts, the beliefs, the things that we learn, the experiences that we have. That is the soul realm of us. My mother told me a story not long ago about when I was growing up. I was a child, maybe around 2 or 3. And for whatever reason, I hit her. And she said she looked at me and she hit me back and I fell on my butt. I got up and I hit her again. She looked at me, she hit me back, I fell on my butt. I got up, I hit her again. She looked at me, she hit me back, I fell on my butt. I got up and I looked at her. She said, I looked at her for a second, I looked her up and down. I gave her the ghetto stare, you know. All the way down to the toes and back up to the head, kind of like, sup. And she said, I looked at her. I shrugged my shoulders and I started playing. I never hit her again. It was interesting to me because the concept of hitting my parents is foolishness to me. That is like signing your death warrant saying, I would like to die now, and I think I will hit my mother or my father, and I think that would be the best way to achieve this goal. So here we go. It's ludicrous. But the point still remains, I did it. I really believe that at that moment in time, my mother trained my spirit on what its place was. The spirit of a person, especially the spirit of a child, doesn't see or understand place. It sees itself as just as important as the parent. So physical correction, not abuse, but physical correction for me taught me my place. So my spirit understood before my mind was capable of understanding. She did not take the time to explain to me, I'm your mother. I love you. It's not right to hit your mother. She didn't go through none of that because my mind would not have been able to grasp the concept, because the concept of mother at that age, I had not learned it. So my mind was too underdeveloped to understand the concept or why it was wrong to physically hit my mother. So she didn't address it at all. Not with my mind, but my spirit learned through my body connection to my spirit. I say all that to say this. As we discuss what we discuss here, it's going to be important that you understand that, so that if you understand and even if you agree with what I say and you wind up doing something else contrary to it, there's three parts of you. The other side of my story here is this. I believe in the concept of majority rule. If you are voting on something, if there's 5 people on the panel, you only need 3 to make a decision. If the democratic principle applies, same thing with your body or with your life, majority will rule. So when you do a thing, there is mind, body, and spirit involved. If you don't believe that there's a spirit, then you're already out of luck, because now there's part of you that you don't even address, that you don't even acknowledge. And that part of you is definitely involved in your actions and the things that you do. For example, if you are a man that's having a problem keeping your penis outside of a woman, and don't get it twisted, it's good where it belongs, which is in marriage. So we have to control ourselves. You might need to be like me and watch cartoons. SpongeBob does not bring out any type of, you know, I'm just saying it helps a brother. Sorry. Moving on. So if that is a thing that you're having a problem with, men, there's 3 parts involved. There's your body, and your body enjoys it. Your body is meant to enjoy it. Sex with a woman is off the chain. It's good. The spirit side of it says this, especially as a Christian, if you are, or just a man of standard, which hopefully is a... Okay, anyway. Sleeping around with just woman is destructive. It's selfish. It takes from her. It takes from you. There's emotions that get involved. It's a lot of energy in that mess. So your body might enjoy it, but hopefully your spirit sees the negative results from it. So now you have two. You have one on one side. You have one on the other side. So now your mind needs to help decide where the final authority needs to be. If there is no understanding in your mind, if you have not trained your mind, if you have not renewed your mind to understand why you should not, you will. If you haven't learned why you shouldn't do a thing, you will continue to do a thing. So if you can elevate your mind and your thinking to understand what sex is, to understand what sex is not, to understand where it belongs, to understand how to control your body and how certain things that you see will help you make, will help you want it more. So if you continue to do a thing, if you can't stop a thing, your body wants it, your spirit or your heart feels bad about it, your mind needs to be elevated. This course and the book, these videos and the book itself, are designed to help the mind aspect of you. Hopefully your spirit desires to grow. Your spirit desires to be a man that is worth following, a man that is a man of standard, that knows how to love and to honor women, a man that wants to be different, that wants to make a difference. If your internal desire is that, that's good. That's most likely rooted in the spirit part of you that's connected to God, that wants to be great, that wants to do good things. But if your body consistently does a thing that your spirit doesn't want, then your mind needs to be put into play. So these videos are designed to help the mind. So the book in and of itself, they're quick things that you might need to maybe send us an email or visit us online, ask us a question, or find a man that you can talk to. The three need to work together. If the body wants it, the spirit and the mind need to not want it. And if the spirit and the mind are in agreement, the body will follow along. So I just wanted to share that so that once you're watching or reading the book, if it's not something that you immediately do, the system is just not working together and you need majority to rule. If you can get the three to work together, if you can get the mind, the body, and the spirit to work together, and if the ultimate goal is towards becoming a better man, then you will eventually attain manhood.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we just want to drop that very, very important information. We're dealing with our Moorish men dying at an early age. What must a Moorish man never forget about his story? What part does his woman play in his life? What about his strong family ties? Does ancient records in history tell the truth about his identity? What is the male or manhood principle? What about the male image in America? And does the Moorish man have a divine kinship? And these are the questions that we are attempting to deal with and much, much more this evening. And just need y'all to hang on with me on this thing as we go into the
grandmama needs their grandson. Grandfather needs their grandson. Son needs their grandsons, needs their grandfather. These are very intricate and very important relationships that go beyond just the superficial. Brother, you need your brother. Sisters need brothers, brothers need brothers. Because what happens in families in terms of the whole building of how we get along with each other and what we do and the dynamics of that, sometimes the sisters can go to the sisters, but sometimes the sisters just need their brother there. They need a brother there. Brothers need the brothers there. You know, uncles need to be there. We need uncles. Nephews need their uncles. Nieces need their uncles. We need all of these relationships. And one of the areas where we have had the biggest difficulty is that not only have we lost all these family relationships, we've lost the important role that men play in friendships. You know, since there are so few men, there are almost no men available for sisters to have just as friends. You see, if you can get a man, you better make him a lover and quick. I mean, that's the kind of mentality that's there. But women need friends who are men. Men need friends who are men. One of the problems with our marriages is that we overload them with making them be everything. My wife and my mate is not supposed to be everything to me. She is my wife, but she's not my buddy. She ain't my pal. She ain't my down man. She ain't my sister. When I try to make her all those things, I explode her by trying to bring so much and put so much on the relationship that it simply cannot be. We have over-defined our relationship trying to fill the gap. Women need men who they can be friendly with. I don't care whether it's an uncle, I don't care whether it's a man who's not related to her. She needs friendly men. What is the problem with brothers out here? Is that brothers are so crazy because they are trying to make women be their partners. Women are supposed to be your partners. Women are women. And they are not the same. The beautiful thing about women is that they are women. They are fantastic in being women. But look, when they got to get out there and go box with you, they got to go out there and, like, you know, kick butt with you. They got to go out there and do all the things, your partner, go shoot pool with you. I'm not being sexually stereotyped. Now, I know some sisters can outshoot me in pool because I don't shoot pool too well. But there are times when you want to shoot pool with one of the bloods. Come on, man, let's go shoot pool together. Because what the energy does when we are together is very different. Simultaneously, in the same way that sisters who have a much better thing at this than we do because there are still enough sisters around, sisters have friendships. That's what keeps them living. If they didn't have, even though some of them spend a lot of time tearing each other down, their sisters do have friendships with other sisters. They spend time on the phone. They spend time talking to each other. And that's the thing that begins to build what's there. We don't have enough of that. So not only are the children missing their fathers, the women missing their husbands, the sisters missing their brothers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but we are missing our friends. And it is out of the friendship that we begin to build the camaraderie that's able to build a community. He needs me to shut up right quick. Okay, let me run through this. So, we need to be socially, we need to be intellectually. Intellectually, we need to have ideas, we need to have analysis. I should have been a dancer last night with a bastard ballet. I was there 3 hours. Now, if I had ideas and analysis, listen. If we had ideas and analysis, listen. We've got to be socially, intellectually. We have to have ideas and analysis, too. We've got to understand that we must think, we must plan, we must have logic, we must have an understanding of how to put things together in reasonable ways. Conferences like this don't come about by people just feeling good. You know, the sister said, like, people say, Akbar's a preacher. I don't just preach. I be thinking. These be hard ideas. And don't confuse me with them preachers. Don't do nothing but sweat and scream and holler. That ain't what we're doing here. We are using an African modality to try to mold a new form of thought. Thought that is holistic. Thought that brings emotion and logic along with it. Understanding that the two things are compatible. That we can feel and think at the same time. And we can think and change feelings and feel and change thinking. And all of that is a critical part of understanding. And that's a part of the other dimension. So brothers don't just need to be able to play basketball and football. They need to understand astrophysics and philosophy. They need to understand that. Brother, you can't simply be good businessmen. You've got to be philosophical men. That was the thing that Ellis and I used to talk about all the time. Look, I don't care how good you are on Wall Street. If you don't have any kind of philosophical understanding of how Wall Street is being used as an instrument to destroy the world, then you are an instrument of that destruction without understanding it. You need to understand that. We have got to go back to understanding that our people have got to be educated. We don't, the National Society of Black Engineers, one of the most valuable organizations in this country. Those brothers and sisters are awesome because they took the fragmented learning of the technology of the Western world and converted it and transformed it into a holistic system whereby they understand now that technology must work in conjunction with ethics, with ideals, with principles, with community building, community reorganization. And they are now about to go into the 21st century and there will be a whole new definition of technology because of the National Society of Black Engineers. They are brothers and sisters who understand the connection between being whole. The third dimension, we must be spiritual. Yes, we must be spiritual. Now, please understand, this ain't religion. You see? Now, religion is one of many ways of stimulating, activating, and ascending spiritually. Good religion helps you build a bigger spiritual consciousness if it's good religion. If it doesn't do that, it ain't good religion. But it is not religion that makes you spiritual. It is the aspiration for spiritual growth that guides you to seek religion. If the religion sees that, then it works for you. We must understand in this spiritual consciousness, we must understand the idea of ethics. Yes, there is a right and wrong. You can't do what you want to do because you want to do it. Not a one of us in here belongs to ourselves. We were brought here and maintained here because people died to make this moment present. You are not sitting in Colony Square because you're cute or because you got a gold card. You are sitting here because black folks who will never get in here died in the streets of Atlanta kicking down doors to get you in here. Listen, listen, listen. Because you are at the University of Michigan, because you are at Stanford, because you're at Berkeley, because you're at Harvard, you think you're there because you're smart? You are a fool. You are dumber than you think you are. You are there because black folks have given centuries to make it possible for you to get inside. So who does that training belong to? Does it belong to you so you can go to Wall Street to make a dime? Hell no, it belongs to us. Bring your skills back to us. That's the ethics that must guide you.
So it's almost like we've been conditioned so well through such a long process that now it is us who are enslaving ourselves mentally.
Because the job has already been...
The job has been done. It would be so easy, in one sense, for us to undo it. That's what I'm saying in this book. Because the way the system of European control works is that you have to accept a concept of reality which makes them superior. If you deny that, their thing will not work, and they will lose their control. So that they put all of this energy into establishing the system that begins when you're 3, 4, and so forth, which defines reality in such a way where there's no spirit, because they aren't a spiritual people, you see, which talks about this objective truth and so forth, which says that African spirituality represents backwardness, so you need to move away from it. It does all of these things which make you as an African person, me as an African person, distrust the very part of ourselves which is our strength.
I'm going to get back to this question, and that is this whole question of do we know what we have lost? Do we realize that we have not always been Democrats, have not always been Baptists, have not always been black Greeks, have not always been Lynx, have not always... how do we conceive of ourselves in a different time?
I think that there is a lot that is being done within the movement of African-centered education in that regard. In terms of, I think we have more information now that we've ever had before. And I have seen the effect of that information. That is very important, that people do begin to realize and understand, first of all, how young Europe is in relationship to Africa, and what we were putting into place, creating, building, conceiving of long before Europe existed. When you open people's minds to that, it can have a lot of power. So that I think that generally we have not understood that, but we have an opportunity to do so because of the work of many people now that is building on work that was done before that we didn't know about.
Other cultures have exhibited aggression, imperialistic tendencies. What accounts for Europe's success?
I'm glad you got to that question.
Mm-hmm.
Because what it allows me to do, I think, is to get at what I think is the specialness of the approach, the method that I used in this study. So it's going to take me a little while, if that's okay.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you all have gotten something out of the first few segments. We're going to go back where we were at the beginning of the program.
Contracted. Now, in a similar manner, then, we can look at education. And education sort of as a regulator of a social economic system. Education and educational opportunity as being expanded or contracted depending upon the social and political situations a nation finds itself in. In other words, educational opportunity is not automatically expanded or automatically given to people just because it's morally right to do so. Education is under the control of a particular set of people or a particular class of people at all times. And that particular set or class of people or race of people expands and contracts educational opportunity according to its particular needs or according to the needs of the state. I often talk in my lectures about what I call European constants. Those things that remain the same despite obvious changes. Now, when you look at the history of our relationship with Europeans, you will note that certain basic things have not changed despite the fact that there appear to be apparent changes, or there appears to have been some progress, particularly in regard to us as African people. For instance, many of us would think in this day and age that we as an African people have a fundamentally different relationship with whites than what our slave great-grandparents had. There are many youngsters today, for instance, when we talk about slavery, will argue that we need no longer concern ourselves with slavery, that this occurred so many hundreds of years ago, and this is not the case today, and that this is really a fundamentally different world that we live in today than before. This is one of the extreme deceptions that we operate on. In a fundamental sense, very little has changed in our relationship to whites since the time we came here as slaves. Why did we come here as slaves? Our major reason for coming here as slaves or for being bought here as slaves was to serve the economic interests of white folk, to be their servants and to meet their needs, to live for them and not to live for ourselves. We, during slavery, and the education of black people began during slavery time, not after slavery, but at the very point of slavery. As we often say, the first on-the-job training for black people took place on the slave plantation. The first forms of being educated for a particular job took place on slave plantation. So how is our being trained for particular jobs today that are still owned by white folk in really fundamentally different from our great slave grandparents being trained for jobs, again, owned by whom? White folk. How is it that you're going to school today to work for white folk is really any different from being trained on the plantation to work for white folk? Even though you think then that because you may be studying computer science today, or you may be studying to be a TV newscaster or something like that, even though you may think that's fundamentally different from the role that your great slave grandparents played, it is really not that different. Because as we've indicated, there were more differentiation between slaves than field hand and house servants. Slaves were also skilled people as well. Slaves were iron workers and carpenters and shipbuilders and what we call millwrights. They worked in factories. As a matter of fact, at the end of slavery, in many areas of the South and in this country, there were more skilled black workers than there were white workers. In other words, there were skilled people among slaves, and there were more slaves with skills than there were free white folk. So the idea then that you may be gaining some kind of skill that your parents did not have, or that your great slave grandparents did not have, does not mean that the fundamental relationship between you and whites today and the great slave great grandparents had and white people during slavery time has changed fundamentally at all. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, the major function of the education of black people, whether we talk about education on the plantation, during slavery time, during Reconstruction, or we talk about education right now at this moment, the basic function of education is for African people to serve the interests of white folk and for African people ultimately to find jobs working for white folk. That has not changed one bit. I don't care what kind of job you may be training for. I don't care where you may think you're going to be working. But in the end, the intention is that we still will be under the rulership of whites. In other words, then, education, just as we referred to welfare earlier, is used to a great extent to regulate the poor, to regulate subordinate people. And therefore, educational opportunity will be expanded or contracted depending on the needs of those who rule over us. If at times they think that they need a larger number of us, they may expand so-called educational opportunity. If, though, the need for educated Africans has been reduced, then you will see a contraction taking place as well. I want you to recognize, for instance, that the issue of our dropping out of school is not the failure of people just to realize that they should stay in school. I argue that the dropping out of African people, African American students, serves a major political function in this system. In other words, our inability or our not completing school served to maintain the stability, the political, economic, and social stability of the United States. And to test what I'm saying, you need to only ask yourself the question today: are jobs in New York City expanding or contracting? Are there more jobs available today than yesterday? You see, is the city closing down on number of jobs, or is it expanding the number of jobs? Are jobs leaving New York City, or are they coming into New York City? You see, in other words then, where are the opportunities for the increased number of students who will be graduating from New York City schools? In other words, ladies and gentlemen, you have to look at the fact that about 65% of the so-called better jobs in New York City are held by white folk. And yet, at the same time, the number of jobs that are available to both whites and blacks or any other group of people in New York City are shrinking. So New York City is faced with a dilemma. It's faced with a dilemma that says, if we educate a large number of people, where would we have the jobs for these people? And if you are one of those educated people, you've gone through 12 years of school, then gone through 4 more years of college education and so forth, and when you get out you find that there are no jobs, you're going to find yourself in quite a temper. You're going to raise quite a bit of hell. You're going to protest. You're going to create disturbances. So then, in order to block these disturbances from occurring, it is in the city's interest that a large number of people drop out of school. So that when they drop out of school, they can now make the excuse that you're not working because you didn't finish school. Of course, you don't ask the question, would you really have had a job if I finished? But since we accept the idea that you have to finish school and have an education to work, as someone says, well, if you had finished, you would have been working, we're willing to then let it go at that. In other words, you can ask the question the other way. What would happen if we educated 80, 90, or 95% of black students, of Latino students, who are the majority of the New York City population now, if we educated them in such a way that they could score as well or outscore white folk? Ultimately, then, that would mean that we as people would replace white folk in the New York City occupational structure. At this point, you would probably see some racism in this town that you thought did not exist. It would be at this point that blatant racism would rise again, to the point as it happened in the South, where people would say, well, I don't really care what kind of educational background you have and what kind of qualifications you have. This is a white man's job, and this is for white folks first. But you see, we don't have to get to that nasty scenario because we drop out before we what? Get there. So it saves the city and it saves the nation some very nasty racial confrontations. That is one of the reasons I argue then that this city and this nation, as much as it talks about preventing dropouts, as much as it talks about improving the educational quality of our children and of our people, never seems to be able to do anything about it. Never seems to be able to change anything. So we have a lot of bleeding heart about how we wish and how we are trying to see to it that our people are educated and that the disadvantaged are educated, and you get great news pieces about some great teaching method or some great educational approach that can resolve educational problems. But then after a month or two, you never hear of the great teaching approach again. In other words, then, we have to keep in mind that it is not in the cards, as far as Europeans are concerned, for African people to ever be their equals. As much conversation as you hear about equality and about, you know, multiculturalism and all of the other stuff you hear floating in the air, the essential thing is that Europeans and whites have no intentions of moving African people from the positions of servitude, and they have no intentions of giving up their power to regulate our opportunities as a people and to regulate those opportunities in their own interest as a people. The other thing that we have to look at, too, is the fact that we as African people, we are a very moral people, you see. We are really moral. People talk about so-called criminality in the African community. But when you really look at us as a people, we tend to be very moral, and we tend to think that people should do the right thing just because it's right. And if people are in positions of responsibility, they should just take those responsibilities seriously and do and act toward those responsibilities in an equitable manner without regard to race, color, or creed. But this is not a reality at all. When you look at the reality of life, people belonging to different classes, people having different social, political, and economic power operate in their own class interests. No matter how moral it may be, and no matter how moral it may sound, there is no way that the Europeans who have the economic and political power and the advantages that they have today are going to voluntarily give them up to you as African people in the name of some kind of moral principle or in the name of Christianity. And I'm saying this because we think that professionals belonging to a particular ethnic group are going to overlook their ethnicity, that professionals class backgrounds are going to overlook their class background, and that they are going to provide equal opportunity for others. You must recognize, ladies and gentlemen, that class struggles and struggles between groups is a reality. You young people here today, I will assure you that by the time you get 80 or 90 years old, there will still be ethnic struggles. There will still be struggles between ethnic groups. Do not deceive yourself and do not fall for the propaganda that someday, some way, little white boys and little white girls are going to be holding hands and people are going to be measured by the content of their character. You got another thought coming. The struggles between races and groups, the struggles between classes and groups has been here since the very beginning, and they will continue to be here. The only people foolish enough to believe that such an age is going to come are black folk. And this is one of the reasons why today they're on the bottom of the class and economic and political ladders, because they actually believe somehow a miracle is going to occur where folk are going to look at them and not see the color of their skin. If you think that day is going to occur, you got another thought coming. If you're keeping up with the news today, if you're looking at what's going on in all over the world, in Yugoslavia, where you have so-called ethnic cleansing operations going on, where the Serbs are fighting against the Muslims and the Croats and so forth. If you look at this situation, here are people who lived under Russian communism for almost 40 years. And under Russian communism, they were taught the ideals of classlessness, that there is really no difference in classes, that there should be no class differences, there should be no race differences, there should be no differences based on religion and so forth. And communism is about reducing differences based on class, religion, and creed. And the Russians ruled over Yugoslavia, ruled over Czechoslovakia, Armenia, and many other nations, and brought them into what we call the Soviet Empire. Now, as soon as Russia fell apart, what happened? These groups fell into ethnic conflicts. And now you are reading and hearing about the ethnic conflicts that are going on in Herzegovina, in Sarajevo, in Yugoslavia. Even if we look today in our homeland of Africa, we will still see struggles within our African nations between ethnic groups. Ethnic struggles and class struggles are realities. And until we recognize that these are realities and they are realities that we have to confront and deal with, we will be victimized by the realities that we seek to deny. And to a great extent, the thrust of this country has been to get us as an African people to deny reality, has been to get our youth so caught up in music and so caught up in clothes and so caught up in wishful thinking and so caught up in multiculturalism that they will not recognize the realities that are going on in the world. As I often tell college classes, you talk about multiculturalism in the classroom, and you're singing other groups' songs, and you're learning to respect other groups and other races. And I ask then, where are the multicultural grocery stores in your neighborhoods? Where are there blacks and Koreans owning the grocery stores? Where are there blacks and Koreans owning the vegetable markets? Where are there blacks and Latinos owning stores and businesses? Where are there blacks and Arabs owning? Where is the multiculturalism that you talk about so much in these schools and in these colleges in real life? When you walk out of these doors and you're taught by multicultural teachers, you're taught by white teachers, and you're taught by teachers from other ethnic groups, but when you walk out of that door, you see essentially one group of people, one group of ethnic people, owning your neighborhoods, owning your vegetable markets, owning your businesses, controlling your community economically. So the reality of the school is not the reality of the world. The glorious sounds of Martin Luther King's speeches are not the realities of the world. And you must come to terms with the realities of the world. And the music that you hear and the hip-hop and the...
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the late Dr. Amos Wilson dropping some heavy information. And I just want to echo the sentiments of what he said. There's some things that we have to do, brothers and sisters. And when we understand this thing, it's so simple. All we got to do, you can do the mirror test. Walk in your bathroom and close the door and lock it and cut the light on and stand in front of the mirror. And look in the mirror and give yourself 3 minutes. Now, you ain't got to do this for 3 minutes. And look in the mirror and see if you change colors. Now, if you don't change colors, that's a good thing. So what we have to start doing after that while we're in there is come to the realization of this is who we are. And so, okay, after we get that, then let's go back. We can open the door now and go out, and let's find all the information that we can on our identity and see if it's worth loving. And what you will discover is everybody on the planet that don't look like you, that has fallen in love with their own selves and embracing their own selves and their own kind and doing everything they can to benefit their own kind, is different from you. We seem to be the only people on the planet, right here in America, African-Americans, Afro-Americans, Negroes, Coloreds, and Blacks, who seem to think that we got the power to love everybody before we fall in love with our own self. You can't do that. So after you come to the realization, after looking in the mirror, that what you look like, and that's going to be with you until the rest of your remaining life, why don't you fall in love with that, embrace that, and embrace everything in your community, in your city, in your state, in your nation that look like you. Love yourself first, and learn everything you can about your own self, your own story, your own culture. And after you do that, then we can go out and start looking at other people. If they fit our standards and their culture, we can check their culture. But not before we do us first. So I wanted to put that information out there before we go to the next plug. And the reason I did that because I actually did what I'm telling you to do. When I was working, you heard the story before. And, I go to work, I had books under my arm. Every book was written by an author that looked like me. Everything I did, would come to eating certain foods and stuff, I was trained by people that looked like me. And knowledge yourself. Europeans, they come up to me and tell me dry jokes and stuff. They start smiling. I'm one of these, okay, well, what are you smiling about? I don't see anything funny. Let me tell you about the great kings of ancient Kemet. I don't want to know. I think we need to do something about all these pictures all over the building of people who don't look like me. Can I put one up that look like me? That's the company say that's the way it goes. Well, the 4th of July is coming tomorrow. Okay, well, I don't know nothing about that, but here's a poster that I'm finna put up on Queen Nzinga and her story. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the money out of my own pocket, and I'm going to buy food for all the ladies in the plant so that they can eat in memory of this great African queen. And so the brother's like, man, man, you ain't scared of losing your job? I said, well, what? What have I done wrong? When has it been wrong for me to love my own self and embrace my own self and my own culture? Just like the Chinese or the Mexicans or the Croatians or the French, the Dutch. Everybody, what's so evil about that? Oh, man, these white folks don't like it. I said, I can't tell. I said, they haven't said anything to me. I said, well, why are you scared? Oh, I ain't scared, man. I'm just saying. I said, well, you going to work with me? No, man, I need my job. So you figure that they're going to fire me for loving myself. No, I ain't say that. Well, needless to say that word got to our headquarters. Headquarters sent a barrage up and down there. And when it got down there, just so happened the timing was right. Whole yard full of them. They sitting right there in front of me. Black, white, Mexican, everybody. They say, what's going on? I said, well, I'm trying to teach them about ancient African history. Okay, all right. Well, we're not going to disturb you. When we get back in the plant, the whole committee came back up to me. Well, you think they're learning anything? I said, well, it's too early to tell. I said, it might be. Oh, okay. Well, we just check. No problem. Okay. I said, all right. Then here comes the general manager. He won't shake my hand. The rest of the brothers and sisters, they right now, they, I don't understand. What's going on? And I explained to them. I said, how can a man respect you when you don't respect yourself? How can he trust you when you trying to look like him, trying to act like him, kissing his boot, licking at you know what, and all this right here, instead of embracing what you're supposed to be? Okay. That's enough of that. I don't want to get to ripping and raving and going on and can on with that. I just want to put that out.
It definitely took a toll on black male-female relationships, especially in the 1960s, because in the 1960s, black men and black women, they were doing what they were supposed to have done for a long time, which was fight together against white supremacy, against racism. And they were doing this with the civil rights movement. So what happened, people had to come in and infiltrate and have a divide and conquer strategy between black men and black women. In 1964, government came in and they pulled black women to the side and they started to classify black women and women in general as minorities. In 1964, that's the first time they classified women as minorities. So they started to give them set-asides and benefits, and then they created the feminist movement, and a lot of sisters branched off into that, and that kind of created a rift because a lot of sisters stopped fighting for civil rights and they started to fight for women's rights. But women's rights weren't being jeopardized in the black community. Our first priority was racism, and we should have dealt with that first.
We wanted to be free. We didn't need any boundaries, need no man to tell us what to do. Well, we hadn't had no man to tell us what to do anyway. You couldn't tell us what to do in slavery, so who, you know, we didn't really have no fight with you about that. That was the white woman's fight with her man, but we took it on. I want to be free. Ain't nobody going to tell me what to do. And then women started having babies, what they call out of wedlock, and then that got to be okay, too. Oh, it's all right. Once it got accepted by society, all of the rest of the people, then it was okay then to just have a baby. In fact, I don't even want him for nothing but to just have a baby. And then we started saying, well, I'm going to be the mother and the father. All kind of nonsense. And so what happened was that movement, and there never was a sisterhood in the women's liberation movement between the black woman and the white woman.
Because you have to understand, in the tactic of the art of war, when you want to destroy a stronger enemy, you have to get rid of the cultural perspective of authority. So what do? You have to destroy the man in the society. And that's exactly what they did. I talk about this in my book. You have to destroy the masculine principle, which is the head of the family. That's part of it. The other part is to get rid of the environment and the ways and means for the head or the authority of that family to become and stay the authority and the head of that family, and that is to be the provider and the protector. Take away his means of providing. Take away his means of protecting his family, and he no longer has any rights or any kind of power. So when you have done that, you have now undermined the glue that keeps a family together. Men don't have to be men anymore. So what's the best thing to do? Since you're giving so many favors to women, I might as well be a woman.
If whites are involved in their genetic survival and they are threatened by black male masculinity, then it will occur, I have to reduce his masculinity. Yeah, we just recently had the president at Morehouse have to say the male students cannot wear high heel shoes and dresses and carry purses. So something is happening, again, within the total context of a system of racism, white supremacy. Neely Fuller, who wrote the textbook for victims of racism a number of years ago, in the late mid-70s, he used to say in the system, because he was the first person to talk about racism as a system, and he said that as the system of racism, white supremacy moves on, the system is going to have black men wearing dresses. Now, to hear that in the 70s, people said, oh, this is way out. And here we are. You see, there are some black pediatricians who are saying we are developing epidemic levels of the effeminization of young black males. Well, I say the pants sagging down is just a subconscious invitation for homosexuality. You see, it's revealing the buttocks. See, so the pants are getting lower and lower and lower. The next step is to step out of the pants altogether. And so you step out of the pants, you're going to put on a dress. Your feminization is an essential ingredient of white genetic survival. And the only thing that can prevent it is black people becoming conscious or becoming determined that this is not going to happen to them, because if the black men are destroyed, then the black people are gone, and we have the state of genocide.
It's like when I see that they put every black man in the movies in a dress at some point in their career, I'll be connecting them, dog, like, why all these brothers gotta wear a dress? This happened to me. I'm doing a movie with Martin.
Yeah.
The movie's going good. So I walk in a trailer. I'm like, man, this must be the wrong trailer because there's a dress in here. They come in. The writer comes in. I think he's the writer. He's like, Dave, listen, he got this hilarious scene where Martin's sneaking out of jail. So he disguises you as a prostitute. And he put this dress on. And, huh? What? A prostitute? Nah, I'm not doing that. I don't feel comfortable with that. That should have been in the discussion. What? You don't feel comfortable with it. I mean, it's a hilarious bit. All the greats have done it. So, well, if all the greats have done it, it's kind of hacky, right? You're right. So why don't we just not do it? Because I don't feel comfortable wearing a dress. Oh, come on, Dave. Listen, we got it all set up. We're supposed to shoot. Every minute you waste costs this much money. You know, the pressure comes in. Huh. Now I'm not wearing no dress, man. I'm funnier than a dress. Just give me something funny to say. I don't need to wear no dress to be funny. What am I, Milton Berle? Blah, 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 blah. You know, we're going like this. And then finally, it's like, and he leaves. And then, like, the director comes, Dave, it really would be great if you wear the dress. What is wrong? What is this, Brokeback Mountain in here? So, wear the dress. I don't want to wear the dress. I want to wear this dress. You know what I mean? Oh, gosh, this guy's so difficult. They leave. Now the producer comes, come on, David, would be so... Right, I mean, and then I started thinking about it. All the comics that I've seen, man, you know, strong brothers, why are they putting us in these dresses? But the minute it was clear, I was adamant, I'm not wearing a dress. I'm not wearing the dress. All right, fine. Think of something else. That comes back 10 minutes later. The whole new scene, how did you write the scene so fast? You know, it's like, so you got to take a stand.
are together, and that the ruling pharaohs who were greatest in their time were the pharaohs who pulled the diversity together, who brought unity, who brought balance, who brought harmony, who brought peace. And the peace came by being able to reconcile the discrepancies. Let's look at some of the symbols that the king used to manifest his responsibility. You see, one of the things we often forget, again, in our limited thinking, we try to picture the king as Ronald Reagan or something bizarre like that. Yeah. We begin to think that, oh, this is a, oh yeah, oh, I understand, like, you know, like Bush is the president, then Ramesses was the president of that time. No. That is not the way it is at all. Because Bush was never cultivated to be a leader. Bush was cultivated to build bushes and to get money and to wield power and to be manipulated by power holders. He never came into consciousness of himself. He never came to know who he was. He never learned to cultivate his will. And most importantly, listen, no one ever taught him of his unique relationship with God. He doesn't understand that he ain't nobody but a vessel, a vehicle through which the God is manifesting itself. He does not understand that it is not his will, it is the will. He does not understand that he cannot choose to deprive justice because justice will make itself rise, as John Wiley Price said. He cannot choose to distort and disorient truth because truth is coming back, because Ma'at flies around above the head of the distorter. Listen. Now, so when we talk about the Pharaoh who was a real divine king, we are talking about someone who worked and built a kingdom. We are talking about someone whose authenticity as a leader is manifested in terms of the benefit brought to the people. In terms of people don't work well if people are not living well. People don't produce well if people are not thinking well. People, no matter how you're a fool, you see, again, this Western thinking. We assume that if anyone built a mighty empire like Kemet, they must have had slaves. They feel that you must have had to exploit the human spirit, because the only way we could build America was by exploiting the human spirit. Listen. The assumption is that, again, it's this extrapolation, this projection that the way we did it is the way it has to be done. So look at these people. If they built these pyramids, if they built these temples, if they built that, they must have had slave labor, because look at us. We ain't got too much of nothing. And look, we needed slave labor to build it. We had to exploit human beings to build it. We had to rape people to build it. We had to kill people to build it. We had to steal goods to build it. We had to commit genocide to do it. So that must be how they did it. You wrong again. The only way that it was done was not exploiting the human spirit, but cultivating the human spirit. So, yes, there were workers, but there were workers who had discipline, who had will, who had commitment. Dr. Van Sertima told us last night about how the Japanese said, oh, I know how they did it. They simply used technology. And certainly our technology is greater than any other technology. You right? If you're talking about stereos and CD players and VCRs, if you're talking about Nissans, Toyotas, and Kawasaki's, you're right. But when you're talking about building the human spirit, you ain't talking about technology. You're talking about a metaphysical force that is there. And that's what was used. Listen. Until these people understand that the people must be built first, then they will never be able to replicate the power of the building of that time and of that era. The greatness of that time was that the people, the spirit, the soul, the intelligence, the coordination, the union within began to come together with the union without and brought together a powerful transformative force that changed and transformed the whole of the known world. Now the only way you can get that way again is to do like the divine king did. Not tap his passion. Not tap his war arm. Oh yeah, he went to war once in a while. He wasn't no passive nothing. You know, a tiger fights. A leopard will tear your eyes out. A lion will eat you alive if you mess with him. The lion will trample you if you get in his path. Yes, people defend themselves militarily, but it is not the military that builds the world. It is not the imperialism that develops the culture. If you notice, Kemet was not built in Spain. Kemet was not built in France. Kemet was not built in South Africa either. Kemet was not built in Antarctica. Kemet was built in Kemet. They didn't go outside, they built from the inside. Imperialism was not a necessary prerequisite for building a mighty kingdom. All they did was build the nation from inside. Now, that we must understand the nature of the union to begin to bring together. In all of our communities, folks, we have got to learn how to work together. If you are a ruler, if you are a leader, if you are a thinker, you have got to be about building bridges, not tearing them down. Listen. You have listened to me, please. You have got to understand that as long as you go around talking about those doggone Muslims, those doggone Christians, those doggone this, you are tearing down the union. You are breaking up the kingdom. You need to understand that when I come here as the spirit of African people of all times and all places, and I come to unite all of us. I don't care what name you call God, as long as you know there is a God. I don't care how you get to him. Listen to me, please. Please. You must understand that until you can see against the distortions that are used to divide us, you can use your intellect to divide when you think you're putting us together. You must understand that the polar opposites have got to come together. You've got to understand that in the distortion, there is truth. And we must understand that as we join hands with our brothers and with our sisters in all walks of life, we brought together the most powerful force on this planet because it represents the unification of the diverse and the divided kingdom. You've got to understand, brothers and sisters, that until the Alphas start working with the Kappas, ain't gonna be no men left in America. Listen. Until the Deltas and the AKA understand it ain't about red and white or pink and green, it's about black. And once you put that together, you got something. Listen. Until the Muslims understand that it ain't about Saudi Arabia, it's about Africa. It's about America. Listen. Until the Christians understand it ain't about the Pope, it ain't about the crucifix, it ain't about Jesus, it's about bringing life to the dead Jesus mind and resurrecting the spirit of African people. That's when we'll have an ascension of the Holy Spirit to bring life into all the world, to re-innovate a world that has been lost. I sound like a preacher. Let me shut up. Let me go on. Listen. Slavery alienated us from the identification with God. Slavery disrupted the interconnection between us and God. 2 years ago, I was blessed, along with so many of our thousands of others, brothers and sisters, to go to Kemet in the most powerful show of intellectual African strength since Pianke took it last. When we showed up there, the whole world shook because it was no longer a social tour. It was the mind of Africa coming back to see what it had left, coming back to dig up its own treasures. And all of the world said, we better ignore this. We better not look at this just like they're doing here. At the press conference yesterday, they didn't come. The television cameras didn't show. Not all, every one of them in Dallas should have been. They should have flown. Walter Cronkite should have been outside with Richard Brokaw talking about. I'm telling you, listen. The New York Times should have sent a reporter rather than a spy. They got a spy here, they should have sent a reporter. They should have sent somebody from the Wall Street Journal, because they need, whether they announce it or not, this mess is over, because we've come home now. We've come home now. Listen, 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 listen. Praise be to God. Yes, sir. Thank you. Praise be to God. Listen.
A lot of Moors would raise the flag of Morocco. Talk about, it's a red flag with a five-pointed green star in the center. But let me tell you more something. That's not the Moorish flag. It's the flag of Morocco, true. But Morocco and Moorish is two different things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You are Moorish.
That's right.
Okay? Morocco turned their back on you.
Mm-hmm.
Sold you into slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Under the Mohammedan rule.
Right.
That they call Islam, as taught by the Arab, they call themselves Sunnis and Sufis and Shiites and think, they were selling you into slavery. You don't believe me? I'm going to tell you about a slave document that's very little spoken about by its true name. It was written in 1786. It was written by the Sultan of Morocco. Name was Muhammad. And it was an agreement that was compiled with George Washington, who was the head of the Masonic Order, who was also the ninth president under the British rule and the first president of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Mason.
Mm-hmm.
I said it.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Western Freemason. Now, let me tell you the criteria. Let me tell you the criteria for being a Mason. And I want you sisters to listen so these brothers won't fake y'all out no more.
Demonstrate.
Because ain't none of them here can do nothing with Pleasant Bay. I am the truth.
Wow.
Okay?
Demonstrate.
Ain't none of these brothers here that call themselves a Mason. That's not true. A real Mason, a Western Freemason, okay, must be pale skinned. That's number one. Age 21. Made a sound mind and body. That's the criteria. Do you know any of them? George Washington was. Thomas Jefferson was. Okay? You don't believe me? Let's stick a little further. Don't your brother get offended, though. Don't jump on me. Not, give me a minute. Okay? Now, when it comes down to George Washington, let's take a good look. The whole Revolutionary War was about two Masonic lodges that couldn't get along with each other over some land that didn't belong to neither one of them. Okay? Two Masonic lodges, the Scottish and York Rite Orders. Okay? They didn't agree with each other over some land that they were taking because they had firepower. Okay? I know, Christopher Lovell discovered a place that 50 million people already use it. I know about that. Okay. But these Masons, now you must remember, Western Freemasonry is to set aside for one thing and one thing only, and that's to enslave the entire continent of Africa and all of its inhabitants. That's the sole purpose of Western Freemasonry. Now, I'm not talking about Masonry. There's a difference. And again, don't you brother take your hat off yet, because I ain't finished. Okay? There's a difference between Masonry, which the origin of Masonry come out of Egypt.
That's right.
The Grand Lodge of Luxor, okay? And what it had to do with was self-mastery. You must remember, the origin of Masonry is what? Know thyself. Self-mastery. The more you know of about yourself, the more you become what? God.
That's right.
Because it's just God in human form. You must remember, it's not in the power of the flesh to think or bones to reason. So therefore, something's added unto you, God, that's unlike this. What is it? It's some level that can connect you with the original source from which you come from. That's what makes you God. Now, bear in mind, now God doesn't come in gender, so I don't hear all that stuff about, well, I'm a matriarch. It don't come in female and male form. Okay? That's a lower level. That's what?
Remember, I just told you, it's not in the power of the female bodies or the male bodies to do what?
Thanks
for a reason. So ain't no God all up in there. At least not till it gets feeling good.
Go ahead, man. You tough. I love that part. Go ahead, man. Expression.
Y'all know about them false sensations, right? Ooh, baby, you know.
Lay it on, boy. Don't jump with them. Teach.
And when you don't know no better, that God can take you out, too.
That's right.
Why? Because there's a God that's outside of yourself.
Yeah.
And he's using you to get there. Mm-hmm. Okay? But George Washington and his other Masonic brothers, we've got some Moors running around today hollering about their Masons, not realizing that they are helping to enslave their own people. Because this is what Western Freemasonry is all about. Mm-hmm. What they did, there were three brothers, they call it Jubilee brothers. Jubilee.
That's right.
I'm sorry. France. France, Britain, and the United States. Jubilum, of course, the United States. That's the one that set them all. Knocked you in the head. That's why you look silly right now. Don't know who you are from nothing. Okay? That's that set them all. Okay? The rest of them took you out also. But they only hurt you just a little bit. And then they had the nerve to plant an acacia tree over top of your coffin.
Demonstrate
it. That also had a five-pointed star on the top of that coffin. Okay, it's called a shallow grave. You want to really know what that shallow grave looked like? Remember, George Washington was the one that dug the grave that put the coffin in it because he was a Mason. You don't believe it, do you? Okay, listen to this. When George Washington got in office, he said he wouldn't trust nothing but a Mason. All his boys, there were 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence, and all of them except two were Masons. And not one of them looked like us. Not one. Now, I know Prince Hall. No. Let me tell you about Prince Hall. Don't y'all get offended. Okay? Let me ask you a question. What's the difference between a Negro slave and a free Negro? Anybody know?
Nothing.
You're right. Ain't no difference. They're both Negroes. And a Negro is what? A slave. No matter how you look at it. Okay? What's the difference between a black man and a free black man?
Nothing.
They're both black. They're both slaves. Okay? Now let's get a little personal. What's the difference between an African American? Never mind.
A couple weeks ago, we told you some folks in Fort Wayne are trying to get out of their U.S. nationality in exchange for one called more. But some wonder if they're also trying to get out of U.S. obligations like paying taxes. Today, some local Moors sat down with us to answer those concerns. News Channel 15's Aisha Husney joins us in Studio 15 with that story. And Aisha, they think you're Moorish too.
Yeah, you just never know, Mark, do you? That was definitely an interesting thought thrown out there today. Even more interesting, though, the separatism in their beliefs. Take a look.
Moors is a group of people. It's not a club. It's not a religious cult. It's actually a race of people that has been here since the ancient times, actually from the ancient Moabites.
What we call black or African American, Tah El Ali calls Moor.
Moors is a race of people, the original people of the earth, the woolly hair, the thick lips, big nose, copper tone skin.
El Ali says he's Moorish. So does Jabbar Gaines L. For them, it's more than just an ethnicity. It's a nationality that trumps any other.
We never was a U.S. citizen to begin with.
And with that, they say they don't have to obey U.S. laws or fulfill any U.S. obligations, like paying taxes.
Do you pay your
taxes?
I'd rather not.
Well, the Constitution, I pay taxes, but I do so under threat and duress and coercion.
So if they don't believe in U.S. laws, then why record documents at a U.S. office, like the Allen County Recorder's Office.
It's just giving proper notice, so then if we ever do get involved with some type of trouble, they would know our status, and we are not a subject of their city.
I also asked them, how realistic is it to live in this country and not follow its laws? They say that they follow the U.S. Constitution, and they're confident that any judge would side with their argument, and that's something I'll definitely look into next. Reporting from Studio 15 tonight, I'm Aisha Husni, News Channel 15.
A couple weeks ago, we told you some folks in Fort Wayne are trying to get out of their U.S. nationality in exchange for one called more. But some wonder if they're also trying to get out of U.S. obligations like paying taxes. Today, some local Moors sat down with us to answer those concerns. News Channel 15's Aisha Husney joins us in Studio 15 with that story. And Aisha, they think you're Moorish too.
Yeah, you just never know, Mark, do you? That was definitely an interesting thought thrown out there today. Even more interesting, though, the separatism in their beliefs. Take a look.
Moors is a group of people. It's not a club. It's not a religious cult. It's actually a race of people that has been here for since the ancient times, actually from the ancient Moabites.
What we call black or African American, Ta El Ali calls Moor.
Moors is a race of people.
So it's almost like we've been conditioned so well.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I want to stop right here for just a second before we go into the next plug, and I want you to think for a moment, and along with what I said earlier and what's been broadcast to you this evening about being yourself and embracing yourself and studying yourself and everything about your culture and your story, also been told by Dr. Amos Wilson about the educational system and all that. So what we did is we have created one of the most comprehensive libraries inside the United States for Moors, Negroes, colored, black, Afro-Americans, African-Americans. And that way you and your wife and your children would have a power base to draw from. See, what we have to understand is the prophecies concerning the future of this country has already been laid out. You don't have to wrestle and toil to try to straighten anything out. They've already been foretold it's going to happen. There's nothing you can do to stop it. The prophet said, I'm going to leave the European here long enough to teach you how to run a government. The day will come when $20 bills, what we think is money, which is not money at all, it's just fiat currency, it doesn't have any gold behind it, it's worthless, will roll down the street and nobody will pick it up. So in my personal opinion, I think we got a head start. And so therefore, what we need to start doing now and what we should be doing now is going ahead and embracing our power base and studying and getting prepared to fulfill the prophecies that's already been laid out before us. That makes all the sense in the world to me. And for those of you who are ready to begin, if you haven't begun, you can get your free articles from me. If you just send me an email request and just say, well, Tahaka, let me get your free articles you talked about on your broadcast, and I will send you the 14th Amendment Exposed as well as the Commerce Game. That way you can get started. I also want to relate something that I laughed so hard yesterday until I almost cried. I received a letter from a bill collector, a third-party debt collector, and It says that well, you owe over $600 for this ticket that you got, and we are debt collecting. This is an attempt to collect the debt. Now I thought that was very, very interesting because if I'm supposed to be owing the Jacksonville Sheriff's Department with all their guns and their badges and their, you know, we put you in jail and we gonna do all this here. Why is it that they sold this particular debt
to a third-party debt collector. And so what I did is I contacted them. And I said, well, don't you find it strange that an entire sheriff department would refuse to come and try to handle me in a collection for a debt, and they sell the debt to you, and here you go, sending me a letter talking about collecting the debt. Why would you be foolish enough to take your own money and buy this particular debt from the sheriff's department? Common sense should have told you something's wrong. What kind of man is this? Well, if you got all these guns and badges, you say he owe you, why didn't you go and arrest him? Why didn't you put out a caper for his arrest? Why would you take the debt and send it to me and tell me, who ain't got no gun, no badge, well, see if you can go get him. See if you can. So I said, don't you find that kind of strange? Well, actually, now that you bring it up, that is kind of strange. Who are you? I said, well, who are you? Well, I'm so-and-so law firm. I said, are you Aboriginal, indigenous to this land? Well, I live in New York. That ain't what I'm asking you. I said, do you have a nationality? And if so, could you tell me what it is so I can determine whether or not that you Aboriginal and indigenous to this land and have always been here? Because I'm a member and a citizen and a offspring of the ancient Moabites. There never was a time when we were not on this land. We're the originals. Y'all the one that come up with the term Indian. I said, well, are you a Caucasian? Well, what does that have to do with anything? I said, well, what's your nationality? I don't want to talk to you anymore. I said, well, okay, you go and hang up. I understand. Are you going to pay this debt? I said, won't you come and arrest me if I don't? And he hung up the phone. I just thought I'd relate that story because I felt it was so funny. And I think I'm going to take this letter and put it in a frame and hang it up on my wall. And every time I pass by, I'm going to look at it because it is the most interesting document that I've ever seen in my life. This is quite amazing.
How does it work? Why is it successful? And then ultimately, we need to look at the spiritual implications of this system. And it's the implications of us internalizing it for our consciousness. The European cultural construct is based on a concept of truth, which implies European power over African people. That is what we will argue. Their energy comes from destruction, and it becomes destructive, and it is destruction. They are the destroyers, as Aikwe Arma would tell us. Get and read the book 2000 Seasons. Their culture is a culture based on death without rebirth. They are the desert which knows no giving. The system of domination is successful because everything in the culture works for one single purpose, and that is the achievement of European power. Everything in the culture is focused on the achievement of that power. Everything is for that purpose. It is single purpose. And power here is defined as power over others. That's very important. That is critical. Power over other. We have to ask the question, what is truth? For each culture, each people, each race defines truth and the method for reaching that truth. We can have a definition of truth which is spiritual and which is joining. It is possible also to have a definition of truth which is materialistic and separating.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're coming to the end of this broadcast. Don't forget to tune in on the 1st of July, and we're going to allow the brothers and Europeans to tell us all the intricate details of their government and how we can capitalize on their financial our financial aspects of life here inside the United States. And these are heavyweights, and this is a very, very powerful broadcast. And I just wanted to say I hope that the brothers have gotten something out of this. I've done my best to make sure I bring the most potent information to you. And keep in mind that everything that you're listening to here this evening will be put into to Hawker's library, and so you will have access to it. You can go back and listen to it. The day will come when I will leave this plane again, and it's called death. And but this time I hope to leave a legacy behind for you and your children and your grandchildren and your great-great-grandchildren. And all we have to remember is methods and techniques change, but principles never change. These truths that you heard this evening rung true when they were first spoken and put down on paper, and however it came way back then. But today and tomorrow and all the way into the future, they will still ring true. If we can understand that, harness it, and just go ahead and take it and use it the way we are supposed to use it, we can get further ahead in life. I feel I have no choice but to embrace myself, my culture, and my story. It is my duty as a divine minister of the Moorish American government to teach my people and prepare them and leave them something, a benefit that they can use in this life. We all know that knowledge is power, but power that is not acted upon, in my opinion, it's pretty much worthless. So therefore, we're coming to the close of this broadcast. You can contact me at area code 904-303-9061. And y'all contact me before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And if you got questions, comments, and if you want to get a hold to Hawker's Library, you just contact me. And now we get that. This is private. This is for you and nobody but you. So, therefore, you can call me, and I can determine whether or not it's you. And then we can get this in your hands. It is the most comprehensive library inside the United States. It is awesome. I'll have to walk you in there, because if I don't, you will get lost. There's no doubt about it. And I'd like to commend the brothers and sisters that have already gotten access to this. That's in constant study. I'm looking at the statistics and the numbers here, and they are amazing. So I know that we are making progress in doing what we are doing inside the United States. Okay? There won't be any music at the end of this broadcast this evening, because it was too much information I had to bring to you. And I hope you have gotten something out of this thing. And we only have 20-something seconds left, but I also want you to once again request my free reports to 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Game. You do that by emailing me at taharaka9@yahoo.com. That's TARAHAKA99@yahoo.com. Good night, ladies and gentlemen.